As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Winning isn't everything. He wouldn't know. He's never lost. Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports. Now on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
The last and final hour for today of Primetime Sports for this Wednesday, the 26th of the month. Bob McCowan, Ken Reed on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks. Bob Nicholson, Vice Chair of the Oilers Entertainment Group, will join us in a little bit. But some football talk as we get set for U.S. Thanksgiving tomorrow. Three games on the docket, beginning with Chicago at Detroit, then Philly at Dallas, and Seattle at San Francisco. The last two pretty good games, Chicago-Detroit, I don't know. A couple of years ago, Andrew Luck and Robert Griffin III were debated among football people as to which should be the number one quarterback taken. Take a look at some stats if you're watching on television here between these two guys. Luck drafted one, Griffin drafted two. Luck's record, 29-14. Griffin, 13-20. Passing yards, 11,000 and change for Luck, 7,000 and change for Griffin. Touchdowns, almost exactly double, 75 for Luck, 38 for Griffin. I bring this up because Griffin is being benched by the Redskins for this weekend's game. On Monday, Jay Gruden, the head coach at Washington, indicated that Griffin would probably be the starter, but they'd look at the tape and make evaluations, and then a day later decided, nah, we're going to go with the with Colt McCoy, the ex-Cleveland Brown quarterback. Don Banks of Sports Illustrated joins us. Where do you go with Griffin now? How do you get him back into action? I mean, I suppose if Colt McCoy is bad, they can go back to him, but what do you make of that whole situation?
It's been a it's been something that's almost felt inevitable the last few weeks because he's struggled. Gruden has kind of distanced himself further and further away from Griffin. The dynamic is interesting, though, because the owner obviously is ultimately calling the shots, Daniel Snyder. He's the one who kind of put the franchise's cachet into that deal and really thought it revitalized the franchise, gave it a face, won a division title. So I say there's no real putting the genie back in this bottle, but Daniel Snyder could think otherwise, go with a coaching move, another coaching hire this offseason, somebody who thinks they can fix Robert Griffin, and this thing may have a third act in Washington. But if they stick with Gruden, I think it's pretty clear that he doesn't feel like the future of the franchise is Robert Griffin III anymore.
Well, I'm not sure he thinks it's Colt McCoy either, but, I mean, that's what he's got, right?
But, you know, when he doesn't feel even confident enough to start Griffin the last five games of the season, in order to play it out and see if there are any signs of improvement, you know, or transition to this new offense, they're still trying to do what was seen as necessary. Take Griffin's dynamic skill set and turn it more into a sustainable pocket passer in the NFL without losing all of the dynamic skill set that made him so attractive in the first place. A lot of people thought that was going to be a difficult thing. But then when he comes out in season one and makes the plays that he made, you thought, well, maybe this is just the new way of playing quarterback in the league. But as your comparison to open the segment proved, the traditional pocket passer in Indianapolis is far outperformed kind of the new wave dual threat quarterback in Washington.
So what do you think it is that Griffin is struggling with? Is it this? Is it the restrictiveness of Gruden's offensive scheme?
I don't know if restrictiveness is the word I would use. I think he struggles a little bit with. Is it the word discipline of going through your progressions, of sticking to an offense that says most of the time you're going to have to deliver the football in the pocket? And he,
well, that's what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah, he was so used to making plays outside of the pocket,
right,
and having success doing that at Baylor. And then again in year one in the NFL. And he's, look, his reads and his decision-making have been questioned. His own coach picked apart his footwork and his mechanics, even when to go to a 3 to 5 to 7 step drop, and basically said that he thinks too much. So that's the sign of a quarterback who feels a little overwhelmed by an offense and has then been rendered less of an athlete and less of, I guess, a read and react type player by an offense that he doesn't totally grasp.
So, Don, let's say if Washington did go the route and they did change their coach and they did bring in a guy that let Griffin be Griffin, is there any evidence to you that suggests that Griffin could be a success over the long term?
Well, I think most people thought if he could adapt and transition his game so that he's not putting his body at risk as often as he did in his rookie season, which obviously didn't end well, that you could get maybe the best of his dynamic playmaking and still get a Griffin that can be effective when he has to deliver the football from the pocket and win a game that way. But no one's unlocked that combination. And the hope was that Gruden was going to be able to do it, but it obviously has not worked. The injury that he suffered in week two kind of threw everything on hold for about 7 games. And then when he came back, the season was kind of, if it wasn't lost, it was already on the brink in Washington, and that changes a little bit of how he had to play. And I think it's been somewhat predictable in that they probably brought a coach in who has a system that best fits an Andy Dalton type of quarterback, and they gave him a quarterback that is really very far on the spectrum from Andy Dalton type skill set.
With Don Banks of Sports Illustrated. Okay, let's begin by talking about the 3 games that will be played tomorrow. Briefly, Chicago and Detroit. Is there an issue for the Lions to bounce back from what happened against New England?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, they lost to two of the best teams in the league on the road. No real shame there. But they didn't score a touchdown in either game. They got outclassed in New England by 25 points. And people are starting to say, what's wrong with Matthew Stafford? His percentage, I think, was 39% completions last game. Was that a career low? You know, people are starting to say, I thought the Lions had offensive playmakers. It's been Golden Tate. Even Calvin Johnson has been quiet. So, yeah, this is an important game for the Lions. Not only are they 7-4 after being 7-2, but this is a game in front of their home crowd that if they come out there flat tomorrow, and the Bears, who looked like a total calamity 2 weeks ago, find a way to beat the Lions, then I think all the air comes out of the balloon in Detroit, and you're going to hear same old Lions, and you're going to see another season swirling down the drain. Because remember, last year they were 6-3, and they lost 6 of their last seven games to kick away a almost gift-wrapped on a silver platter division title.
Yep.
With Aaron Rodgers hurt in Green Bay. And if they do what they're in the process of doing now and they can't win tomorrow and can't stop the bleeding, you're gonna see the, basically the instant replay version of last year.
Philadelphia-Dallas. Who do you like in this one?
I went back and forth. I had to do my picks today. And I went with Dallas, but I did it with not much confidence. For one, I think they had to really, really burn a lot of fuel to get that win Sunday night, comeback style, against the Giants. And that showed me something, that they were able to do that. And I think the possibility is that the Eagles could go out there and throw a big number on the board against them if they're spent. But then I think, well, wait a minute now. The Eagles are the team traveling on a short week.
That's right.
It's an incredibly quick turnaround. They're going to have some jet fumes that they're working on as well. So I really think I gave it to Dallas like 24-21, 27-24, something like that, on the belief that Sanchez has been good for two picks a game this season so far. And I think those two picks tomorrow, Dallas will probably make him pay for and turn into 7 to 10 points, and that'll be the difference.
How do you explain Dallas 5-0 on the road, 3-3 at home?
Yeah, that, and I pointed that out. It's weird. It's as if they feel like on the road they're playing with a certain amount of house money, and they're showing people that they can do what we don't expect them to do. And then they get home where they have the level of expectation that few franchises do in front of their home fan base, and they simply aren't the same team. Either they play more tentative, or they're worried about, well, we should win this game. So it has been a team that has kind of flipped the script, and when we don't expect Dallas to play well, they have, and vice versa.
Don, will Seattle-San Francisco be a perfect way to end your day tomorrow?
I think, first of all, when Seattle won on Sunday, it gave us a race in the NFC West. And no matter what you say about the AFC North, which is certainly even, Steven, but that's largely based on the fact that they got to play the NFC South this year and went 10-1-1 so far. The class of this league is still the NFC West, and the fact that we now have a legitimate three-team race in the last 5 weeks is going to be fascinating. But I do think it's the best rivalry going in football right now, and I think their games, they're not always artistic, but they're always dramatic. And I think Seattle gets out of there with a win, even though they haven't won in San Francisco / Santa Clara, where they've never played before but will tomorrow night, since 2008. I think the Seahawks put something together against the Cardinals on Sunday on the we finally came together as a team front, and I think they put something together as a defense, and we know that team is led by the defense. When they got Bobby Wagner back at middle linebacker, and they got a healthy Cam Chancellor back at safety.
Can I ask you about Richard Sherman and Doug Baldwin, what you thought of their little act yesterday?
I didn't love it, but I also thought it was fairly creative. They were making the point in a somewhat clumsy way that the league has a lot of inconsistencies built into its policy, that it loves money from alcohol companies, but, please don't get any DUIs and embarrass the league on that front and be sober stewards of the game. And then they were making fun of, the league has its own headphones contract and we can't even mention ours. And of course they came down the hardest on the fine on Marshawn Lynch not talking to the media. And personally, I don't care that he doesn't talk, because if he's going to waste our time and turn it into a charade, good riddance. Tom Brady doesn't say a word that's really, really, really worth hearing in his press conferences, but he's always up there smiling and charming and regularly takes his turn. And I don't think that's real valuable either, to be quite honest. So I don't care that Lynch doesn't talk. I don't want my time wasted any more than anyone else does. But I do think, in some ways, if the fans cared enough, then he is kind of stiffing the fans. I'm not sure the fans care.
Well, I think that's the point.
Marshawn Lynch to get his 100 yards, and they want to win on fantasy football. And I don't think they really care that they don't hear from him after the game.
Well, I couldn't care less, to tell you the honest to goodness truth. I
I'm with you.
I
don't want to get on a soapbox and say, oh, Marshawn Lynch got to talk to us, and then have him the ability to go up there and yank our chain and give us yeah answers to questions that don't even have anything to do with yes or no.
I don't need to make a big thing out of it.
What do you do if no one speaks, though.
So it gets to that point. It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
I get it. But that's one of those hypotheticals that's never going to happen. There's going to be enough guys to talk, and it's never going to be an all or nothing. So the Marshawn Lynch, we almost make him into some sort of cult figure, martyr, whatever, pick your term, by, you know, continually, oh, you got to talk. You go, well, if he doesn't have anything to say and he doesn't want to say, fine, I'll go talk to somebody else. I don't believe you can make a man talk who really, really, really doesn't want to talk.
What gets me about it is his teammates don't really seem to care that he doesn't speak. You know, I think they don't only care,
they defend him.
Exactly. The only thing that would get him to talk is if his teammates turned on him and said, man, you got to stand up for yourself or whatever, but they don't seem to care. So if they don't care, I don't see what the problem is.
Well, I mean, they don't care because, one, you know, it's not their job to get anything out of Marshawn Lynch. He talks to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to go out of their way to say, oh, you got to talk to the media because it makes us all look bad. No, it doesn't. It makes him look like Marshawn Lynch. And, you know, if that's his act, I get it. He doesn't want to be social when we're around. But it isn't really about us, per se, as the media. It's supposed to, as the league sees it, it's supposed to be, well, you know, you're talking to our customers. But, you know, it's become so warped, and now it's us against them with the media, and that's fine. You know, I don't care enough. I'm with you, Bob. I don't care enough to think that this is a big issue.
Well, I don't care about talking about it to any athlete. And, I mean, you mentioned Brady, but, I mean, look, 99.999% of all interviews, conversations had with active players in any sport are fundamentally a waste of time. I mean, I understand that people are out there that feel that that's part of their job is to get quotes from athletes, from active athletes. But the truth of the matter is, if you go back and look at what they said, it's irrelevant. It doesn't take you anywhere. So, you know, now if you're going to sit down and do a one-on-one with Marshawn Lynch, have you ever tried to do a one-on-one with him?
No, but he wouldn't entertain that. So, no, I have not.
No.
Not even when he was in Buffalo. I don't believe.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know what you're going to get out of him. And most of those one-on-ones, I think you have a better chance of getting something than the pack mentality, you know, you know, deal that you get after every game.
Look, there are guys. See, I would quibble with your number, your 99.whatever. There are guys that can be really insightful even after a game and in a locker room and kind of enlighten your coverage. As I was a beat writer and I did it.
Yeah, I know.
And you had go-to guys and you knew, strangely, there were many times offensive linemen who I find are just usually the big picture guys on the team for whatever reason. And you had a lot of guys that were go-to guys and you knew if you went to that guy, they would give you the big picture perspective that would really give your coverage some meaning and some heft. But, you know, the vast majority are guys that are, you know, you're just going to waste your time trying to get something that's not there and it's not going to be there. And if you're covering a team like the Patriots, God forbid, you might as well just go bang your head on the locker room wall because you're not getting anything. So I think all that's overrated as well. But, you know, to turn Marshawn Lynch into this you know, some people love, oh, he's you know, he's stiff in the media, and we love it because the media, you know, gets all righteous and says, you got to talk to us. Well, I don't get that way. I think, whatever, move along. There'll be somebody else interesting to talk to, and maybe, you know, maybe someday no one will even care about what Marshawn Lynch has to say or doesn't.
Well, put me in that category right now, if you like. I mean, if you're making a list.
I'm in that category.
Yeah.
I understand that he's a key player on one of the top teams in the league, so people are going to attempt to talk to him. But
he
made it pretty clear that he's going to turn that into a charade. So I say, stop playing that game.
Funny you say that, Don, because I'm just watching one of our other channels is on the monitor, and they just had back-to-back clips from Tom Brady and Bill Belichick, and you don't really get a lot out of those guys.
And that's about, what, that's 12 minutes of your life that you'll never get back if you watch those.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine they said anything of any interest whatsoever, and why we would play it is beyond me. But, you know, there are people that make these decisions that should be doing something else.
Feeding the beast.
Cleveland at Buffalo this week, and they're actually going to play in Buffalo. Although I think the Bills would rather they play the rest of their home games in Detroit based on their performance last week, or on Monday, rather.
They're 2-0 there, right?
Yeah. So this is an extraordinary division with Cincinnati at 7-3-1, and that and how interesting that that tie, which you rarely get in the National Football League.
Which I lauded, by the way, at the time, and I said, watch, it'll come back to help Cincinnati win this division.
Well,
and it
might.
A couple times recently.
You're onto something.
Baltimore, Pittsburgh.
Could again.
Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, all 7-4. The Browns go into Buffalo. The Bills coming off a, I mean, it was a big win, but it's over the Jets. I don't know what that means. And Cleveland on the last play kicks a field goal to beat Atlanta in Atlanta, which is a good sign for them, I think. Who do you like there?
I probably will pick the Bills because Cleveland has a roller coaster effect going this season, and they stole one that they didn't deserve to win. Hoyer tried to give it away. The Falcons refused it. Mike Smith's clock management was hall of shame material.
Yeah.
So I'll probably pick Buffalo because they played with a little confidence the other night, but look, I think the whole division is as close as it really seems to be, so it is really gonna come down to, you know, one team is gonna blow a game that we did not foresee them blowing, and it's gonna turn the whole division race. I still think Baltimore comes out of that division, but Cincinnati's in the best position at the moment because they've steadied themselves. They go down to New Orleans. They go down to Houston. They get two wins after the debacle at home against Cleveland. And right now, the arrow's pointing up in Cincinnati.
I don't trust the Bengals.
Why? I don't either.
But you like them to win.
I don't like them to win the division. I'm saying Baltimore, I think, comes out of that division.
I'm sorry.
Yes, Baltimore, it was my preseason pick. I'm not deserting them. I think they're actually the best team, the steadiest team in that division. But Cincinnati has, you know, they look like they were about to have the wheels come off after that Browns Thursday night debacle. And they, you know, to their credit, they went on the road in the Gulf Coast region two straight weeks and got away with wins.
Quickly, let's talk about Sunday, New England and Green Bay. What's the significance of this game to both teams?
I think it's more important to Green Bay, probably. I think, first of all, they're in a first-place tie. No, I'm sorry. They're a game ahead of Detroit, but they're still a game away. New England, to me, could lose an NFC game like this and still get the number one seed in the AFC. I think they will. But to me, Green Bay needs it. It's a home game. If they have a shot of running down the Cardinals, and I think they do because the Cardinals have a tough schedule, they need this game. We use Super Bowl preview sometimes far too often, but this really could be a legitimate Super Bowl preview because no two offenses are playing better. Both defenses are better than we thought they were going to be. And, you know, for my money, these are the best two quarterbacks playing in the game right now.
I have a hard time seeing Green Bay win this football game. Explain to me how they do it.
I think they can. I think they can almost match points with New England's offense, and I think they could make a play or two on defense to give a short field or even score points that could make the difference. And if it was in Foxborough, completely different scenario. But in Lambeau, where the Packers are undefeated this year, I think they could definitely win a 3-7 point game against the Patriots with one key defensive turnover, a fumble, you know, by Shane Vereen.
Thank you.
But a heck of a dancer either way.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't know Ben Vereen had an NFL career. But
I didn't either, but I've made that mistake many times now. Shane Vereen. I'm dating myself when I dropped the Ben Vereen.
The fact that I knew exactly who you were talking about.
I know. That's why
both of us.
It's nice to be young. That's all I'm going to say.
Thanks, pal. As always, enjoy. Have a great Thanksgiving, and enjoy the weekend as well. We'll talk next week.
Thank you, sir.
Don Banks of Sports Illustrated. Who do you like in Green Bay, New England?
I guess I'll go with the home team. I'll go with Green Bay because if New England, like kind of like what Don says, if New England loses, it doesn't really mean a lot to New England. But if Green Bay loses, it kind of, you know, it clouds things up for them. So, but I'll go with Green Bay just because Aaron Rodgers is pretty
Let me give you some numbers. Let me give you some numbers from the last 4 weeks.
Is Green Bay offensive numbers?
No. 51-23, 43-21, 42-20, 34-9.
Mm-hmm. Margins of victory for...
That's the New England Patriots scores.
That's the Patriots.
The last 4 weeks.
And what are I wonder what the Green Bay ones are.
Probably. Well, they had like those... The 50s.
50s, yeah. Pretty snappy games, too. So, Gunslinger Sunday, is that what you're thinking?
It sure looks like it, but, you know, and I'm guessing the weather's going to be okay in Green Bay this weekend. I haven't seen
that's
anything.
That's important. That's important.
Well, I mean, you know, so the offenses should be able to go. And that being the case, you know, I think we're going to see in the 60s or 70s. I have to think you're going to see that many points, don't you?
I honestly, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be.
I don't either.
No.
I don't think either defense is overwhelmingly good.
No. I don't think you're going to see a 6-3 game. Like you'd see, you know, 19-18 if there was such a date.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how New England comes out and plays, given that the last 2 weeks they played two entirely different styles.
Well, that's just it. What are they going to look like? And the fact that they played those two styles and still put up numbers is pretty
impressive.
Well, and
impressive. One going away.
Yep.
I mean, outscoring their opponents 76-29 with two entirely different offensive schemes.
And that is what makes them extra dangerous.
Oh, yeah. The Edmonton Oilers aren't that dangerous. What do you do about it? Bob Nicholson is the still new vice chairman of the Oilers Entertainment Group. He will join us when primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
Tim and Sid. So funny, you might pee a little. Luckily, you can listen on the can. Subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. On demand. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Five before the hour. This is Primetime Sports, Canada's most listened to sports talk show on the Sportsnet radio and television networks. I'm Bob McCowan. That's Ken Reed. There's a real interest in the Edmonton Oilers, and I don't really totally understand it across this country, and especially on this network.
Mm-hmm.
I voiced this earlier today. And maybe there's an absence of stories in the National Hockey League that the... Well, the story of the Oilers is one that everybody seems to keep focusing on. Not as much talk about Vancouver. They're doing great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a spurt of Calgary conversations. Not much has been said about Winnipeg or Ottawa. Maple Leafs and the Canadians get their fair share in their markets and nationally. But Edmonton's story is an intriguing one, I suppose. Last seven games, they've got 1 point.
Yes, winless in seven.
Yeah. And on the road, and they play, Thursday, Friday? Nashville?
They have Nashville, St. Louis, back-to-back, Thursday, Yike. Friday. That's not easy.
Our friend Bob Nicholson, longtime head of Hockey Canada, left there in the spring, and this summer agreed to a position as vice chairman of the Oilers Entertainment Group, and he joins us on the telephone. Mr. Nicholson, how are you?
Not bad, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm good. So tell me about this gig, first of all, before we get to your hockey team.
Yeah, you know what? It's an unbelievable opportunity, Bob, what's going on in Edmonton, you know, with this new whole development. I really thought I was coming into, you know, a new arena. And, you know, when I get here, the arena is just 20% of what we're developing downtown. It's going to be huge for sport and entertainment in Edmonton. And I think it's going to be, you know, attractive to everyone in Canada to come out and see this facility. It's very, very special, and, you know, it will open September 2016.
You've got a year and a half, almost 2 years still to go, huh?
Yeah, we've, you know, a year and a half, but it's, you know, steals out of the ground, and you know, you're really starting to see shape of it. And we've already done contracts for, you know, for the city office building and the hotels and casinos, and now we're looking at various restaurants, and you know, a lot of great activity all happening in the development.
How big is the footprint?
28 acres in total. So it's huge, and the neat thing with it, it's right downtown. It's right downtown Edmonton, and you know, not too often do you get that opportunity to build something this big right in the middle of the city. And you know, now we're looking at some other options for land around it too. So you know, this is phase one. It'll take us through till, you know, 2019 to get it all done. But when we walk out from this arena, we have a winter garden that'll hold 2,500 people into a plaza for about 9,000 people, and then all these activities around it, and it's going to be special.
I assume there's some residential in there, condos?
Yeah, there's condos. We're looking at some apartments. So, you know, it's just going to really drive a lot of people downtown, and it's going to be the place that everyone wants to go.
So how... You know, you're a hockey guy. I know you're a business guy, but you're a hockey guy. How much do you get involved with the Oilers?
You know what? I've been getting more involved as I go along here, and you know, really started all off on the business side, but you know, have dipped my toe into the hockey side a little bit here. But you know, everyone's concerned where the team is today, and you know, everyone's working hard at it, and we can't get out and make huge changes. We just got to take it step by step. And you know what? It's fortunate because I was through this, Bob, and you remember interviewing me probably right on this same radio show when I started with the juniors my first year. We went over there with a star-studded lineup and, you know, were disappointed and came back in seventh place and got things retooled and did it over some time, and then started winning five world championships in a row. And that's the approach we have to take in this. We can't start to, you know, just tear everything down. We just have to make sure everything that we do is we got to get a solid plan as we go forward here of how we can get this team to win a Stanley Cup. That's the ultimate goal of every team in this league. We're a long ways from that, where our record is today. We all realize that, but we just can't panic here and make major changes unless they're going to help us in the future.
Bob, how does the fan base react to those kind of thoughts? Because they've been hearing that for a long time in Edmonton, and they've been pretty patient for the most part. What's your message to Oilers fans who've been through a lot in the last few years?
Yeah, you know what? I feel for the fans that have been through this for, you know, 8 years. It's certainly not something we wanted, but, you know, we've got great fans. Let's be clear on that. We have, I think, the best fans in the league to be where they are with us today. Are they disappointed and a little angry where we are? Definitely. And but they're going to hang, I'm sure they're going to hang in there with us. There'll be disappointment, you know, the other night against the Chicago, and there should be. If there wasn't, we'd, you know, I'd be worried about where the fans are. But we have to show them that, hey, we've got some exciting things coming here. We got, you know, the great new building that they're really excited about. There's going to be no other fans in the National Hockey League to get to go watch a game in a building like this. And we got to get the team better, and we know that's our mandate.
Bob, I was working in Edmonton when the talk of this new building started up, and everybody was really, really excited about it. And I think a lot of people were thinking the Oilers would have a much more competitive team by the time it came for this building. Are there any concerns of apathy settling in, and maybe not having the hottest team to start with in this brand new building?
You know, we talk about that daily. That you know, we want to have a real good team going into this building, and we still have time for that. But you know, we're going to have to go back and, you know, look at every part of the hockey organization. We're going to have to look at, you know, all of the staffing, all the scouts. You know, how we scout, how we look at developing the players from the time that we draft them through the minor leagues. You know, and we got to get better at all of those. And we can't sit here and say that we're knocking any of those key things out of the park, because we're not. And you know, I think the only way to do it is just don't go halfway. Tear it all apart, look at it all, but don't make changes till you really know how you're going to make it from top to bottom.
Well, isn't change necessary? I mean, at some point here, Bob, I mean, you can't just keep running the same play over and over and over again and getting the same results and thinking it's going to be different.
Yeah, you know what, Bob? It's a real good comment. Should there be change? Yes, but we want to make sure that we do the right change. And, you know, you can start to throw out a lot of players. You can change the coaches. You can change other parts of it. I'm a real believer in don't look at one piece for the short fix. Look at the whole piece and then make those decisions after you looked at the whole. Everyone wants us to make change quickly. I certainly don't think that that's the proper thing unless we're 100% convinced that it's going to help us.
Bob, you talk about patience and scouting. I did a little research before the show, and I was looking back to Oilers drafts back to 2007. And since 2007, only one player drafted by the Oilers after the first round is on this year's roster and making an impact. Martin Marinson, he's played in 12 games so far this year. How do you find those better players beyond the first round that make you that make teams better? Like you look at LA, you look at Detroit, they find players beyond the obvious picks in the first round. How do you find those guys?
You know what, great research, big concern. You know, when we're drafting, you know, the first and second pick overall, you know, we're getting the very good players. But we need to get more out of those second, third, and fourth round draft picks. That's for sure we have to. But now you look at that, is that scouting or is that development or mm-hmm. a combination of both of those? Or do we have to do things differently? And those are the things we're really digging into right now, because to build a team, you have to be able to draft well, but you have to be able to bring your players up through the minor leagues. And at this time, as your stat clearly shows, we're not doing that. And so there's something wrong in what we're doing as an organization.
What's your take on Dallas Eakins as a coach?
You know what? What I've seen of Dallas, I think he's done a real good job. You know, he's in his second year in the National Hockey League. I don't think there's a better valued coach in the National Hockey League. I think he has, you know, great work ethic, and you know he's going to have to look and work with his assistant coaches on the style of play that he's got our team playing in, how he can adjust. He's worked real hard at it, Bob. He went out this summer, you know, made sure he went to the football camps. He did a lot of different things for some of our players, but it's still not working, and he has to find out a way for this team to be successful under his reign.
Based on your observations over the last couple of months, is this team as constructed as it currently sits now? Is it capable of making the playoffs? I'm not talking about this year. I don't know whether this year's even a possibility. I'm talking about this nucleus. Is this nucleus good enough?
You know, right now we still believe in the nucleus of this team. I think that, you know, we're going to continue to evaluate that. I think that the skill level of those players is very good. You know, Greg McTavish looked at a lot of support pieces to that nucleus this year. In some cases, they've been what we thought, and in other cases, they haven't been. And you know, there's no question we thought we'd be in a lot better shape right now than we are. I thought we played really good early, and we lost a lot of games by, you know, just bad breaks and big turnovers. This team plays very well, but it has big turnovers that hurt us. And in the league today, when you make those mistakes, they really hurt you, and we've lost a lot of games by one goal.
The consensus seems to be you need a stopper. You need a goaltender.
Yeah, you know what? You always want to have the best goaltender in the league, and our goaltenders have been good some days, but in other games they haven't been good enough. And but I'm not going to throw this all on top of the goaltenders. This is a team game, and we've lost games and we haven't scored. We've been shut out, so it's not the goaltender's fault in those games.
We would be remiss if we didn't give you an opportunity to say something about your friend Pat Quinn.
Yeah, you know, Bob, in all our discussions how much Pat Quinn meant to Hockey Canada through all those championships. But, you know, to me personally, we were great friends. Spent a lot of summers together and had a lot of laughs together. And you know what, Pat is a good friend, was a good friend, and will always be. And I know to Sandra Quinn and Callie and Val, you know, they lost their husband and dad, but we'll always have great memories.
Bob, we've seen some great images of Pat over the last couple of days. One that keeps popping up is the 2002 Olympics. But I wanted to ask you about the 2009 World Junior Championship team. I mean, he's a guy that goes in and coaches this team. He's in his mid-60s, and he goes in and he coaches a bunch of teenagers. What was that dynamic like, just watching that, the two totally different generations of hockey working together for the same goal?
It was pretty neat. You know, now you think of the other assistant coach there, Willie Desjardins, and his shoes now coaching in Vancouver. But Pat was, you know, we had to bring him in late to be the head coach here, and he'd wanted the under 18, you know, he'd wanted every level. But the moment that defined Pat Quinn in that junior tournament was we were playing the U.S. team, and they got out to, I think, a 3-0 lead on us. And, you know, most other teams would have folded, and he just was able to give them enough positive feelings that we hung in the game. He stared down the U.S. Bench and coach at a critical time during that game, and we came back and won. And, you know, then the Everly goal against the U.S., you know, those were great moments. And the players won the gold medal, but they wouldn't have won without having Pat Quinn behind the bench.
I was going to say that to have a coach like Pat, who's always been described as, you know, a player's coach, a guy who believed in his players, for a group of teenagers, that has to mean a lot, as opposed to maybe just having an X and O's guys, which I'm sure a lot of those guys played for, you know, going up and going through the system.
I think when Pat came in, they shook a little bit. Got their attention.
That too.
Yeah, you know what? Pat was a person that went in and, you know, didn't say a lot, but really made people accountable. And I can tell you when you're 18, 17, 18, 19 years old, and you have that guy come in the room, he got their attention quick, and he made all Canada proud.
Nick, always good to catch up. It's been a while since we talked. Let's not wait as long the next time we talk again.
No, I'd love to talk to you again, Bob, and look forward to seeing you next time in Toronto.
Bob Nicholson, the vice chairman of the Oilers Entertainment Group. Well, does the coach go? Do players go? This conversation about David Perron being traded, but I don't know what you get for him.
I think Bob made a great point when he said, is it drafting or is it development or is it both? So that is something that they have to look at. Because you can draft the right players, but if you don't develop them properly, you know, through Oklahoma City, with the Oil Barons down there, or however they come up, you have to develop the players you draft. So I think that was a very good point.
But what does that mean?
Well,
you mean to make change down there?
Throughout the entire system, there's a reason why some organizations look at Detroit. They say you can watch Grand Rapids play and you can watch the Wings play, and you can't really tell the difference because they all play the same system and everything looks the same. And when you're a Red Wing, you're a Red Wing. So they say once you're an Oiler, you're an Oiler for life. But maybe the Oilers have to start looking at how they bring their young guys around. And remember, back in the 2004, 2005, they used to split a minor league team, you know, and that hurts you. And
yeah.
Maybe we're past that now, but they, you know, you got to draft right and you have to develop right.
Well, it's a mess, and it's been a mess for a long time. And if you're an Oiler fan, it's pretty hard to be optimistic either now or in the distant future even. Our thanks to Bob Nicholson for joining us, to Don Banks for being here. Mr. Reed, will you be back tomorrow?
I will not.
Oh.
It's a cameo this week.
Well, drops in, drops out. That's Ken Reed. He's occasionally on at other times on this television network.
Waving on the radio.
That'll do it for us. We'll see you again tomorrow night. Good night from Toronto.